You don't become the world's most valuable women's sports franchise by accident. Angel City Football Club did it with a little help from HubSpot. When they started, data was housed across multiple systems. HubSpot unified their website, email marketing, and fan experience in one platform. This allowed their small team of three to build an entire website in just 3 days. The results were nearly 350 new signups a week and 300% database growth in just 2 years. Visit HubSpot.com to hear how HubSpot can help you grow better. All right, back to the pod.
My brain hurt for 24 hours, but then I feel great for that.
Okay, well, you're all right now. Well, we'll see. We'll see, actually. At the end of this episode, I'll give you a grade on your CTE status.
Thank you.
I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, less travel, never looking back.
But let's just remember to say something about you can review on Spotify now.
Haha, we're here. You can leave reviews on Spotify now. Go do that. I have done what was asked of me. All right, let's start the pod now.
All right, we're supposed to tell people to give us a review on Spotify, but you can only leave stars. You can't leave comments. I read all of our comments to understand like what we're doing.
I read our stars. So between the two of us, we got it covered.
Okay. Well, then we're good. Dude, we have a lot to go over today. Because you're like a pain in the ass to get a hold of, I wanted to ask for your advice today, but you've got some interesting stuff. Wait, you want to ask if I got knocked out?
Well, first of all, yeah. Are you going to be able to do this pod or are you like post-concussion syndrome right now?
What happened, man?
And how did it feel?
Yeah, it was like a flash. I was unconscious.
You were sparring. It looked like you were practicing boxing. So you were sparring with somebody. Is that a amateur, a coach? Is that just like a dude?
The kid was probably 20 years old. He was a young guy. I'm going against all these young guys. And like, for the most part, they kicked my ass. And I was doing great. I was doing really good. And then he just caught me on the chin. And you saw the video? I got knocked out.
I saw the video. You just looked like you had wobbly legs for a second. You didn't look like you
got
knocked out.
No, I was falling over.
You fall over. Like you didn't fall down though. So
no, I was out. It went black and I started tipping over and then I caught myself and I woke up. Yeah, I was just for about 2 seconds. I was out.
And what does that make you feel? Are you questioning your chin? Do you feel like a new man? Like what's going on?
It didn't like it. Okay, so here's how I feel right now about boxing. I love it. It's awesome. I think we should all do it. I am scared about the long-term pain. Like I think that is not good to do long-term. I'll probably do it for 6 more months.
Right.
And then I'll probably chill. I think that Jake Paul has said that like he has like memory loss already and like people like mocked him. They're like, oh yeah, okay, sure, Jake. I totally believe that, dude. Like when I got hit, I was in pain for 24 hours.
Oh, you were in pain. Okay. What was the pain? Just like the concussion type pain?
I just
had
a headache. Yeah. I had to go home and go to sleep. My head hurt.
Had you had a concussion before or is that the first concussion?
I've had concussions before from falling and playing ice hockey. Yeah, it hurt. I was in pain for 24 hours. My brain hurt for 24 hours, but then I feel great for that.
Okay, well, you're all right now.
And then...
Well, we'll see. We'll see,
Then,
at the end of this episode, I'll give you a grade on your CTE status.
Thank you. That night, I was at a bar or a restaurant sitting outside, and then 12 police pull up with their lights on, like a screeching stop, just like a movie. They go, they pop out of their car, they grab their ARs, they cock it, they go, everyone, run inside. And... I was shocked. And we like ran inside and it got word to us that there was like, they said an active shooter. And I guess the story of what really happened was that they think someone shot a gun, an AR, because they said there's someone walking around with a rifle. And so we got locked in this restaurant for like an hour just waiting. And then they just left. I have no idea how it ended. I've got no idea. I don't know what happened. I have no idea if it was a real person. I've got no idea. But
it's
they locked
how
us.
We end the podcast. We just leave.
Yeah, that's what just happened. They just left. And they go, we're looking for him. They go, we're looking for the guy. You got to stay in there. But there's a man that's shooting a gun around here and we don't know where they are. And
wow.
So that's what happened to me this weekend.
Were you? Okay, two questions. I find this fascinating because I lately, whenever I play with my daughter, like kids, they just fall all the time. They get hurt super easily. They don't know anything about anything. So there's always getting in harm's way. And you don't want to just constantly be telling them to stop. But that means you got to kind of be reactive if the fun play actually turns somewhat dangerous. And three times in a row, something was happening and my reaction was so slow and she would get hurt. And then I was like, why didn't I just... Like I saw it coming and I'd be like, hey, watch out. But like, that's not going to do anything for a kid. They don't know what that means. I was like, I need to dive and grab her and like, you know, barrel roll away from the situation. Like there's a rattlesnake in my backyard and my daughter was like 6 inches away from it, a 4-foot rattlesnake. And I like pulled her away, but I wasn't that quick. You know, we were at the playground and someone was swinging on the swings like crazy. And she just like walked in front of the swings and got like basically hit in the head by this girl swinging. And I saw it and I was like, hey, like as if anybody cared. And so I'm like, okay, I've been working on my emergency reactions. I'm like, no, I'm my dad muscle. Exactly. I'm going to be quick with that dad muscle now. And my wife is the opposite. Like, I think moms have this where if she senses like from peripheral vision, something's, you know, the bookcase is falling, she turns into like a literal bat and flies across the room and like swoops in and saves it before anything even happened. And so it's like, she's amazing with it. So my question to you is, when it was, hey, everybody get inside now, were you like quick on the draw? Were you like the first one in the room? Or were you like, hey, what's going on?
Did you
like intellectual about it?
I'm very alert. So like I've been places where like I was walking in San Francisco and I was with Sarah and I go, that guy's getting mugged right in front of us. The guy's holding a gun at that other guy. And it was like a block away. I'm like, we got to turn around. We got to walk away. And she was like, how'd you see that? So I've always been very aware. I have a strong protective instinct, I think. So right when it happened, I was like, all right, let's be aware of our surroundings. But yeah, so I'm good at that stuff. I think it's just a personality trait. I think because you are so calm and relaxed, you don't get rattled very easily. Remember, you were telling Ben Levy that when he meets me, don't be angry if Sam yells at you, because Sam is known for like losing his temper. I lose my temper sometimes. I think I get rattled easily. You don't get rattled easily at all.
Yeah, but it has this downside, which is, you know, chill. Like my trainer says this thing. He's like, look, most people live in fight or flight, but there's no threat around them. It's just anxiety about the future. He goes, but if there's a lion in front of you, don't start meditating. Like, go run when there's a lion. And like, that's the part that I actually don't do very well. Is
yeah,
like,
you when don't there's have an actual threat,
I don't really react very much. And that's when you need to.
You don't have a sense of urgency about anything.
Yeah, I'm pretty chill.
But I would argue that you're happier than most people. And that's the major personality component.
But I might die in a certain situation. All right. So that's where that's at. Okay. I wanted to ask you about the knockout and the shooter. That's crazy.
All right, folks, this is a quick plug for a podcast called I Digress. If you're trying to grow your business but feel like you're drowning in buzzwords and BS, then check out the I Digress podcast. It's hosted by this guy named Troy Sandage. He's helped launch over 35 brands and drive $175 million in revenue. So if you want to get smarter about scaling your business, listen to I Digress wherever you get your podcasts. All right, back to the pod.
That's kind of actually related. So you set this Tucker Max thing. Explain what he's talking about and your reaction to it, because I thought it was pretty interesting.
Okay, so there's this guy named Tucker Max. For the people who are at least 30 years old, you'll remember Tucker Max as the author of a book called I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell, which is basically a frat book about having sex and kind of being an asshole and all things that like the dream 19-year-old boy would act like.
Yeah, stories of drunken hookups and stuff like that.
And like kind of being a douchebag, but in a funny way. Right. Tucker is now in his mid-40s, I would think, and he's grown and he's way different. And he recently posted an article saying that the pandemic changed his opinion a little bit. And he is what's called a doom optimist, which means he thinks that there's a small chance, although no, with his, I think he thinks there's a large chance that the world is going to go to shit in the next 2 to 4 years. But he hopes that it doesn't, but he's going to plan for it to go to shit. And he wrote this huge article that was incredibly well written. And my problem with Tucker is that he's just like Malcolm Gladwell, which is like, I have no idea if what he's saying is true, but he's such a good writer that I tend to believe it. And so he wrote this amazing article saying why he thinks the world is going to go to shit and what will happen in 2 to 4 years and how he's preparing by buying a ranch and basically prepping for like 10 plus years of like living without power with his people trying to come and attack him. It's pretty wild. And he talks about physical fitness, learning how to fight, building a ranch with community members on there so you can each take like a watch during the night. It was pretty crazy. After reading it, I felt afraid.
Right.
Is that what you felt like?
Well, I've only read 2/3 of it. But I'm with you that he's such a good writer. He's such almost like a likable writer. He's like got charisma through writing.
Yes.
Very hard to do, but he's very good at it. And that it makes it really fucking hard to assess, like, am I convinced by the argument or am I just charmed by this dude as he writes?
I don't think I agreed with much of anything that he said about the vaccine, about like political stuff, but he was such a good writer that I was like, well, okay, maybe you're right.
Right. You know, like what I would say is this last 2 years, if it's done anything, it really kind of makes you question a lot of stuff. So I think a bunch of people question like, oh shit, I thought I needed to go to the office every day. Turns out I can work from home, or you know what? Like, I don't need this job, or if the world's going to end, you know, how should I be spending my time in my life? Or can I trust the news? Can I trust science? Can I trust this Dr. Fauci? Can I, you know, who do I trust for information about things? Because, you know, one minute they say that masks don't work, and then the next minute they say that masks do work. And like, you know, which one is it? You know, when people said it was a lab leak early on, it was like, you're a racist and we need to shut down the wet markets. And, you know, because that's where this case came from, somebody eating bat soup. And then now it's like, you know, pretty much confirmed that it's like an 80% plus probability that this was from a lab. And sorry about locking you up for racism. My bad. Here you go. You're out now. I just fill this paperwork out before you go. It's like, should we open up the wet markets again? Like, can my brothers go eat some bat soup? Because that was totally wrong. You know, like, you basically had to question a lot of things. So when I first read this and he's talking about doomer optimism, I was intrigued because I never heard of this. This is the type of guy that I think is early on to trends. I think he's early into certain movements. So I'm curious about it from that way. I didn't fully buy or believe everything that he was saying about, like, he was basically saying, like, my buddies told me this is a PSYOPs mission. You know, this looks like PSYOPs, yeah, which is basically like, I don't even
special
know.
Special ops.
It's basically like you go into a country and you create, you shift the, like, the mind state of people in that country by running these, like, sort of like mind control campaigns.
But that's true. That's true. We had a guy on the podcast and he said, my job was to get dropped off into a country and convince people to commit espionage and get them to buy into the American cause versus, let's say, the Iranian cause, and get them to change their opinion. And like,
I believe that that exists. I guess what I'm saying is he was saying that's what COVID is or something like that.
And that's what riots and shit were. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's what the riots for Black Lives Matter, you know, he was like trying to tie all these things together. And he was like, you know, this is the same playbook that my buddies were talking about, but he didn't say the playbook. And that was just became very unconvincing to me. But I will say, I found this interesting and I found it worth, you know, we talked about steel manning the other day, which is that when you feel really strong point of view, one of the best ways to actually understand if you're correct and convince somebody else is to look at the opposite side and say, here's what the opposite side would say. And they're not crazy people. They're not dumb. They're smart and they believe these things, but I think their conclusion is wrong because here's what I believe. And then you laid out both arguments as strong as you could side by side and you picked the better argument. And so I actually, when I saw this and I was immediately like, whatever, you know, paranoid, crazy guy. Now I've learned to not write off paranoid, crazy guy,
totally,
but to actually steel man the argument. And so that's what I think is worth doing with some. I think if you read this, it's worth reading for both the writing style is good. And then the second thing is to practice steel manning. And that's kind of what I'm going to do from this.
I agree. And I did the same thing. And you know what I told myself? So like, I'm like, well, Tucker's crazy. No one acts like this. And he talked about like being persecuted, whatever. And I started realizing, like, do you remember the Rwanda? First of all, I was like, well, like, you know, World War II wasn't that long ago where, like, right, you know, a group of people were collectively murdered. And then I was like, well, you know, Rwanda was like in 1997. And the same thing happened where a group of people were like systematically hunted down. And, you know, do you know about the Rwanda?
No, I'm nodding my head, but I have no idea what you're talking about.
Rwanda is a country in Africa. It's in,
I got that part.
Yeah. And there is Hutus and Tutsis, I think is how you say it. It's two different, I don't know the right terminology, but I believe they're just different ethnicities of some type of like African ethnicities, two different ethnicities. I believe it was people are going to shit on me. One of them, I forget, the Tutsis, I think, were the ones that got killed. And it was like 3 or 2 million of them were killed in like 3 months or something like crazy like that. It was tragic. And that was and Bill Clinton was president. So that was in the 90s. And I'm like, well, that wasn't that long ago that like crazy bad stuff happened. And then I was like, well, fuck, September 11th. I mean, I remember that. And I've got friends that, you know, I now live in New York. Like, of course something bad can happen. And then the pandemic, I felt scared. It wasn't the same, but I felt scared. I remember being in San Francisco when rioting was happening. And I was like, man, like something bad could happen. It was close enough that all these things have happened that I do sense like, man, maybe I should question, like, not, I'm not safe all the time. And so my prediction actually is that the thing that's going to happen that we should, that I should be looking out for is a hacking attempt. I think it's like, I think that like in 5 years, we're going to look back, in 10 years, we're going to look back and be like, I cannot believe that we used passwords in the way that we did. Like one person would use the same password into everything. And you pretty much could guess it because most everyone uses the password 123456 7 or like something like that. And, or like you just had a post-it note at home that had a password. And basically if you just got that post-it note, you had access to someone's entire financial and personal information.
Yeah. It's wild. There's two things on that. One password or no, LastPass, one of the two came out the other day and was like, hey, master passwords have been breached. It's like, what? It's like, basically this is the thing you're supposed to do to stay secure. And the main thing is that you're, but they, it was wrong. They came back and said, no, actually it hasn't. Sorry. That was incorrect. Bad on their part for that. But it just kind of shows you, you know, just in general, even the attempts at security are difficult and challenging. Second thing is Elon Musk went on Hardcore History podcast recently. And it was shit. Like, I didn't listen to it because I don't listen to that. But I figured you or Ben would like that sort of thing. But I know one summary of like one thing that he took away from it, which is they were talking about like the history of like rocket warfare, you know, like of different types of weaponry back in the day and how that led to like success or failure in the war and like how the Germans had amazing technology, but they had horrible materials. Their oil was like not refined or whatever, like their oil was not a consistent mix. And so it was like ruining their weaponry. And like one of the major reasons that the Germans lost the war was that their weaponry did not function very well because they didn't have access to these like core commodities underneath that the Americans had much better weaponry. And he's just talking about like, you know, in great wars escalate into engineering wars. And that just sort of makes you think like, yeah, okay. So before, if it was like, you know, what guns do my soldiers carry? Then it was like, what tanks do my soldiers sit in and what planes do they have? What boats do they have? And now it's going to be like drones and robots, literally just like Boston Dynamics robots going into places and stuff like that. And then it's just like going to go into just like cyber warfare, which is like, you know, what people think, you know, the Russians did to Americans, you know, like basically brainwashing through social media, as well as hacking and getting access to government secrets and intelligence. And like, dude, this is just going to be an insane frontier of cyber warfare that's already happening and is going to just like escalate over time. Because if all wars turn into engineering wars, then the engineering wars that matter are artificial intelligence and cybersecurity now, and drones, maybe drones and robotics. So that's pretty crazy thing to think about.
So I want to tell you something about Elon and Lex Fridman, and I think you have it on here, but basically Neville Medora is a good friend of mine, and he tweeted out this wonderful video where Lex Fridman interviewed Elon Musk. And Lex Fridman, he did it a couple times, but this one particular example, he asked Elon, when will we go to Mars? And he basically asked in such a way that I think everyone should learn from, and I'm going to explain to you why you should learn from this. But he said, when do you think we're going to go to Mars? He didn't say a word. And Elon sat there for, I think, 23 seconds and just yeah. sat there and thought. And Lex didn't say a word. In silence, he just let Elon think. And then Elon replied with a very direct answer. He said, as soon as 5, as late as 10 years. Like he gave an answer. And the reason why that's brilliant is I have got a friend who actually works with a bunch of CIA folks. And my friend is like a nervous guy. He's kind of like me a little bit. And he goes, dude, whenever I'm around my CIA friends, my coworkers, I find myself talking all the time because they talk very little. And they talk very little. So like when I've sat down, when I've just got to meet them and we're trying to get to know each other over a business relationship, I would sit down with them and they would talk so little because they knew that I was going to fill space because I was uncomfortable with the silence. And I ended up just spilling the beans and all types of stuff. And I appeared weak and told them everything. And I asked them about that. And they said, yeah, we purposely don't talk a lot because we know that if we don't talk a lot, you're going to talk yourself into like telling us what we want to know. And Lex Fridman did the opposite. He shut up and he got the perfect answer out of Elon. And I think that's a wonderful way to interview people for a job, for a negotiation. I watched this funny show about this. It's called like Dating on the Spectrum or Love on the Spectrum. And it's about kids or grownups who have autism and are dating. And I've noticed they do this too. And they'll say something like, so what do you think about how this date is going? Do you like me? And they'll just silently. And I'm like, that is such a brilliant question. like, I wish I had the courage to ask that when I was dating. And the only, like, they had the courage to ask that because they're just, you know, maybe not attuned always with social cues. I wish I had the courage to ask that. That's a beautiful question to ask. And giving that silence and that space and that for that question to breathe, you force the other person to come to a really cool answer for it. And so anyway, that was a really neat clip.
Dude, I love that point. So many things to say about that. First, have you noticed that the people you get along with best are the only people that you can comfortably be quiet with when you are just living life?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that the fact that you can be quiet with each other almost builds a silent trust between people, because it's like, oh, we don't have to. Yeah, you don't have to. Okay. Wow. I'm at ease. I could just be myself. I can just do whatever. I can just be pure. I don't have to be constantly measuring how this is going. So that's one observation. Second observation, great interviewers do this. And like you said, the CIA folks, great negotiators do this. I worked with my dad for about 9 months to a year in his company when I was young. I was like 22 or something like that. And I had always, you don't really know how your dad is at work, because this is like a different scenario. It's like, it's a different context. You know, they come home and they're in dad mode. They're not in like work mode. So I got to see my dad at work for the first time. And I always knew my dad was smart, but my dad was not great with like politics in the office. So, he never really got ahead. It seemed like, the sort of the good looking tall white guy would always get ahead. And my dad would sort of be there, giving the right ideas and the right analysis. But, great. Thanks. Pat on the head and move on. He would be at the, he'd be in the meeting when the decisions happen. And then whenever he goes for a beer afterwards, he wouldn't really be the guy who connects with everybody afterwards. I think that held him back. But the one thing he was great at was negotiating, and I got to see him negotiate. And I used to be like telling him, I'm like, dude, you got like, I would be like, kind of like trying to give my opinion. I'd be like, you need to say something. This is awkward. And he's like, and afterwards he would teach me. But during the time, I'm like, you got to say something. It's so awkward just to do it like that. You want to make them feel, you want to build rapport. He's like, no, in negotiation, you don't want to build rapport necessarily. He goes, in negotiation, there's two types of person who can win. There's the person with the leverage, but we don't have the leverage. And the second type of person that can win is the madman. The madman has leverage. And he would do this intentionally. He would go into situations and he would be the most stubborn guy in the room. He would not be realistic. He would not be cooperative. He would not be practical and pragmatic with them. He would just say, I won't do it. Or he'll just be, basically he would get to this state where he would just say, look, before I would have agreed to this, but now seeing how this has gone, like I will die before we do a deal like this. It's just saying stuff like, he would just get to a point, and it wasn't all verbal. It was just, he would keep repeating the same thing. So they would say, seems like it's really important to you that this happens. And when most people say, yeah, you got it. You have heard me. Fantastic. Correct. And my dad would say, it is really important that we have distribution rights. They'd be like, all right, so you guys want distribution rights, but we have to consider all these other factors. We need distribution rights. I know that you want distribution rights, but we have to take into account these factors. We need distribution rights. And I would be like, dude, why do you keep saying the same thing? And he's like, I am just going to get my way, because I'm going to be more stubborn than they're willing to be. They want everybody to be happy and get along, and they want to be well-liked. And
dude,
I don't care.
This is such an immigrant mentality.
He would do the same thing at the market, where he would say, I only have $6. They're like, sir, you just drove up in a BMW. I only have $6. It's like, I remember once, literally, these are made up examples. This is a real example. We got to an airport and we had been telling my dad, classic, like an immigrant, is just packing so much shit into this suitcase. And I just kept telling him, like, dude, these are not like, this is like more than the quota allows. Right. So, and he's like, no, don't worry. We're going to check this one. We're going to carry this one on. I was like, carry this on. This is a huge bag. Like, this is not even close to a carry on. And he went to the counter and the lady was like, he puts one of the bags on the counter, and especially 50-pound limit, it's like 65 or whatever. And she's like, oh, sir, this is too heavy. And he goes, no, this is too light. I was like, what? And she's like, no, sir, the limit's 50. He goes, no, this is wrong. This bag is light. I have checked. It's light enough.
Does your dad have an accent?
No, but he just like gets into this mode where he just like shakes his head like an immigrant. He's just like, this bag is too light, actually. This bag is light enough. And she was like, and she didn't know what to do. And this little Asian woman, I'll never forget. And she was just like, okay, we'll just put it through. And she just picked it up and put it on the back thing and like went, sent it through. And I was like,
he just alphaed his way to.
He just told her the bag as it was being weighed was too heavy. He just told her it was not even. It's okay. It's fine. Make an exception. He told her it's too light, which makes zero sense in any conditions. And he's just done this so many times. It's like, oh, we're trying to go to the Four Seasons, and they check your ID at the front to make sure you're a hotel guest. And he would get to the front, and he would just be like, so you need to see some ID or something? And the guy was just like, do you need some ID or we're fine? And he's like, you're fine. We just get through, right? He just had this immigrant confidence of like, I can be more certain even though I'm wrong than they can be. I will make them question their being right. And I just saw him do this in so many negotiations. So it reminded me of this like ability to be comfortable in the discomfort. In this case, not with silence, but with something else.
Yeah, these are great stories. This is a good story episode. I'm digging this.
By the way, did you watch the actual Lex Elon interview?
The clips, Lex Friedman clips on YouTube.
Dude, there's one amazing clip. I don't know if you saw it. It's probably the most viral clip. It has to be. When I was watching, I took notes as I wrote this. I sent it to my team because I was like, hey, here's some cool stuff that Elon was saying. Because I was like, oh, you're probably not going to watch this 3-hour podcast. But there's one section where
Lex watch the 3-hour ones. They're too long.
They're too long, exactly. Lex asked this question. He goes like, you're doing these things in engineering that are considered hard or impossible. Self-driving cars, electric cars, reusable rockets. These engineering problems that literally nobody has solved in the history of humanity. And experts, even some of your heroes, will say that it won't work or your method won't work. You know, how do you overcome those and these engineering problems? And he goes, where do you get your strength from and your inspiration? You know, what gives you strength to continue on amongst that? And Elon said quiet, but he's quiet. And it was quiet. Like when you're learning a new language, he was like in his head, it just looked at me like he's saying like, what's this motherfucker talking about? Get strength. Like I don't even do that, but let me just entertain this thought. Like what is he trying to ask me?
Yeah. It's like asking Elon, like, or a normal person. It's like, where do you get the urge to be hungry for dinner?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, how do you remember to breathe?
What do you mean? I just am.
Yeah. And so he goes, he said something and he goes like, I think that you should just decide if it's worth doing and then try your hardest to do it or die trying. And Lex is like, so you don't consider quit, you know, so you don't give up when things get hard. Is that what, and he goes, quitting is not in my nature. I thought that was so tight.
There's this great 60 Minutes where he said the same thing. And someone was like, no car company has ever launched in the last like 50 years, whatever long it's been. You are teetering on bankruptcy. I think it's time to give up. What do you think? And he just looks, it was Scott Pelley. He looks at him. He goes, oh, I don't give up. And that's all he said.
Period.
And it looked like he was about to cry, actually, in that interview. You remember that?
Yeah.
But he just looked at it. He goes, I don't give up.
Yeah, exactly.
And I thought that was really
that's
good.
That's exactly what he did. Lex goes, quitting is not an option. He goes, it is not in my nature.
Oh,
God, I thought that was awesome. So tight. And then he goes, you know, we just carry on. And he paused and he just goes, fuck it. Like, we'll get it done. And like he when he's talking about like the hard engineering challenges, like, you know, and that was his attitude. And I thought, you know, Elon kind of annoys me sometimes with just stuff he does. Like, you know, he's just like whatever on Twitter. He's like trying really hard to be like a
dude, like
meme
when,
cool guy.
When he made the joke about like the guy looking like he just came or like calling him a penis head or something. I forget what he said. I thought that was whack. I was like, that's whack. I don't find that to be
just
funny
like
or interesting.
420, 69, bro. It's like,
I did not.
It's not like that. It's just not funny to me. Not like I'm offended, but just like literally, it's just not funny. So it's like you're saying a joke that doesn't land, which makes you less cool in my books, you know? But when he says shit like this and he actually, you know, his story actually lines up with it, I think it's actually really fucking badass. There was a bunch of things in this that I thought were really cool. He talks about a couple things. Can I just rattle off a couple of the bits I thought were good?
Yeah.
He's like, I think you should learn physics because he goes, there's only the only real rules are physics. Everything else is a recommendation.
That's
like
brilliant.
All public policy, social sciences, psychology, biology, chemistry. These are recommendations. Physics is the only rule. So he's like, you know, when we go to do one of these hard things, I just first look at, are we defying the laws of physics? If we are, then we need to change our plan. If we're not, then we can get it done. He said a couple things.
What a baller mentality.
He goes, you know, physics teaches you not just about physics. It teaches you how to think. So he goes, you know, he gave it again, the example people have heard about first principles thinking, which is like, you don't come to your conclusions by analogy, like this worked, so something similar might work in another vertical. It's like first principles being like, okay, you know, for example, to can a rocket be cheaper? Well, I can give you some opinions, but like, let's start with what is the physical cost of the materials that go into the base minimal rocket that can get to Mars based on everything we know today, or that can get into orbit. And then, you know, they come up with their cost assumption from that, not, well, it costs NASA this and we could do probably 25% better. You know, it starts at the bottom, not top down. The other one he talks about is like thinking about things in the limit. You know, he's talking about Bitcoin and he goes, people argue that money has value. Money has power in and of itself. It does not. And the way to know this is to think about it in the limit. If you're stranded on an island and you have no food, no water, no shelter, but your Bitcoin will not save you. Money itself has no value. He's like, money is a way that groups of people can allocate resources. But if there are no people, then it has no value to you. Even if there was one person there and you said, I'll give you all of my Bitcoin, $1 trillion of Bitcoin for that apple, they would never give it to you if you're stranded on that island. Another, he's like, so here's how we use that idea of thinking about things in the limit in our business. He's like, so he's like, cars, everybody thought the cars would be too expensive. And they were at first. The Roadster was, you know, $100,000 plus. And then the Model S was a bit cheaper and then so on and so forth. He goes, manufacturing things, if you think about in the limit, it's like as you increase your volume, your cost goes down and it will approach asymptotically. It basically means the line will converge just to the cost of the raw materials plus the licensing cost of the intellectual property you're using. So at enough scale, it might be billion cars or whatever, you know, at enough scale, that is what the costs are. He's like, and you think about that, then you say, okay, so then will this work? You know, then you can work backwards into reality. He goes, because most people, the way they do things, which I think is wrong, is they, you know, they look at, okay, given my circumstances, so given the tools and the methods that we know, what can we do? He goes, that will never really yield like breakthroughs. He goes, instead, you think, what is the actual ideal scenario? What is the perfect arrangement of atoms that will yield the best product? Now let's try to get the atoms into that shape. He goes, you actually want both. You want to think in both directions. You want to first think of the perfect product. What is the perfect arrangement of atoms or pixels in a computer product that would be the absolute perfect ideal product? And then you say, what tools, methods, and materials do we have today? And you want to think in both directions, and then you'll arrive at like, you know, a fantastic, you know, best in class product. And that's, you know, what we do for Tesla and things like that.
That's great.
So, you know, he was thinking about things like that. He was describing things like that, which I thought was great. He had a couple other funny ones. He goes, yeah, when a website asks you if you'll accept the cookies, he's like, he was giving an example of like when government regulation doesn't work. He's like, the government's trying to regulate tracking. So then every website just asks you for cookies. It just pops up every time you visit every single website, and every single person has to click accept on every single website now. Nobody reads it. Nobody actually knows what they're doing. But yay, the government regulated that the website has to pop that up. And he said, like, he's like, you know, every time that pops up, it feels weird. It feels like perhaps there's a very small chance that clicking this will open up a tiny portal to hell.
Dude, he's so funny and weird. I love that. It's God, he's so interesting. I feel inspired just listening to you retell a story. You want to do one more?
Yeah.
I have two interesting ones. So
I can pick one.
Scroll down to the bottom. Do you want to talk about my buddy's portfolio or the book thing?
Let's do the book thing. I think that's faster. All right.
So I got curious about something. I saw this. So there's this guy named Mark Manson. Mark Manson has this book called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. Then he created a couple spinoffs from it. So I'll tell you a funny story. So this book was the best-selling book of 2020, I believe, or 19, either 19 or 20. I forget the exact year. And or maybe even prior, but before that, actually. But it sold like many, many millions of copies of books. I actually had dinner at a conference with Tucker, who we were just talking about, and Mark Manson sat next to me. And I was talking to him, and I was like, so what do your parents think about your job? And he goes, well, they kind of make fun of me and ask when I'm going to get a real job. They don't really know what I do. They just think I play on the computer all day and I play video games all day. They don't truly understand like what I'm doing. But they kind of understood it this year when they released a report for New York Times saying I sold more books than Hillary Clinton. So that's when they that's when they kind of understood what I do. And so that's a funny story about Mark. But I looked up, I was curious about something about him, and I Googled, and the first article came out that he had a condo in New York City that he recently sold for $14 million.
And I got curious about that because I think that book, I was like, books can't make that much money, can they? And Atomic Habits this year sold, or so far has sold around 5 million books in total. And this year, Atomic Habits was the best-selling book on Amazon in 2020 or 2021. And I was curious about how much authors make. So I have a friend. I can't talk about his name, but he sold 30,000 copies of a book that was published on a major publisher. And I want to explain to you how much money he made.
By the way, and that 30,000, that's a ton. That's like in the top 1 percentile, you know, I think.
Yes, this book is in bookstores and it's probably in the airport and things like that. So they were given, they didn't have a book before. They were given a $250,000 advance, which is basically just like, here's 250, go spend a year and go write the book. Off that 30,000 in books, they have not made a cent in royalty or licensing fees. And he told me that when he was looking at the contract, he doesn't even entirely understand when he's going to get paid past that amount. And he only gets paid like pennies on the dollar for every like $14 book sold.
Right.
And he said, he's like, basically I get paid. They spent a certain amount of money to help me make this book and they get paid once it surpasses. I get paid once it surpasses that amount. But I can't even understand in the paperwork how much they spent, like including everyone's salaries on doing this and publishing and things like that. But I have made, he said, an additional $400,000 this year on selling other stuff like courses and coaching and consulting, right, which wouldn't have happened because of the book. But basically on 30,000 copies sold, he has not made a cent other than the 250. And he told me that his editor wasn't that good, that he had to spend a little bit of money getting his own editor, and that their marketing people weren't that great. And I found it to be very interesting. And so I looked up Dan Blazarian. Dan Blazarian, you know who he is, the Instagram guy. He self-published his book. And so Dan Blazarian's book, it costs $35 and he has a Shopify store that sells it. You can't buy it on Amazon. And it works for Dan Blazarian because he just posts a link on Instagram and he goes viral. But David Goggins did it as well. And so anyway, this whole publishing kind of thing got me interested because these people do not, I guess Mark Manson, he must have crushed it somehow. But for someone who sells 30,000 books, they don't make shit off their books. And I found it to be incredibly fascinating. I guess if you're like Ryan Holiday, I heard that he does good, but a lot of people, they just don't get paid.
Well, I think it's two things. It's if you take an advance, and it's your first book, the economics can be super skewed against you. If you have multiple hits like a Ryan Holiday, then, you know, by the time you negotiate your third book deal, you're going to have much better economics in the thing. You know, Tim Ferriss probably made more off his last book than he did off the first book, which is the bestseller. And then the last thing is self-publishing, you know, changing the game in a way. So, you know, let's say a book sells for $13.99 or whatever, $14. You know, I think it's going to be like probably, you know, $7-$8 of just the cost of the book plus shipping to get it to a customer. And, you know, so you're left with $4 or $5 at the end to play with. Now, whether that goes all in your pocket or your publisher's pocket, I think that depends on how you negotiate. But even if you just take $4 per copy, you know, 5 million copies sold for Atomic Habits, you know, I would believe that he's grossed, you know, 20 million, 30 million in sales, or sorry, like gross profit off that. Now, I don't know what his deal was. I don't know if he's self-published or what.
Well, 5 million books times $14 is 70 million. So the revenue on that, I would bet, is in the 50 to 100 million range.
Yeah.
That huge ballpark. But I don't know what a guy like him would make, but I bet you he could get paid like many thousands an hour to come and talk. I mean, I bet you it would cost him $50,000 to show up at a boardroom in New York to give a discussion, to get a talk.
I just got paid $8,000 to do a Zoom call for 1 hour to give a talk. And so that means that somebody who's, you know, the author of Atomic Habits is definitely commanding, you know, 25-50K per
That's
talk.
That's crazy.
And now maybe it's digital.
That's crazy. So anyway, I thought this was interesting, and it shocked me. Writing a book, you're going through this. You're thinking about going through it. I don't know how far you are.
Yeah, I basically paid to write the book and now I got to write the book this year. So that'll happen.
And so I would predict that you don't make money directly off of it, but I imagine there will be money made in some ways.
Yeah, I think a book is a pretty horrible way to make money. So I'm just doing it for fun. And that's it.
All right. Well, that's that. This, what an interesting episode. I think this is actually going to be a favorite.
Really? I feel like, Ben, you tell us, but I feel like because we were all over the place with just like random stories, I don't know what people will think. What'd you grade it?
First of all, I should say I'm changing my grading system in 2022 because like the reason that, you know, I came and did this because I love My First Million. So I was giving out A's left and right because like every episode is an A to me, but I need to adjust it so that C is the normal episode from now on instead of A. Okay. So C is just like an average My First Million, which is an A really, but
don't call it a C then. Just say average, normal, or average. Something like that.
Yeah. C hurts me.
Okay. Okay. So then we will call this an average plus.
Is it a new phone? Like,
it's like plus? A C plus B minus. It was a better than normal episode. I actually like the topics were super different and random, but they were all super interesting to me.
What was the most interesting?
Well, you know, I'm into the doomer optimism stuff. So like, I loved that discussion. That was probably my favorite.
Dude, that shit freaked me out. I was upset for like 2 days. I'm still a little rattled by it. It made me nervous.
When you're talking about building these Airbnbs, I was like, no, Sam, you need to go out and start building like compounds, you know?
That's a good point.
I feel like that's going to be a thing in the future.
Sean, do you know that Mormon's Prep?
What?
Like Mormon's Prep?
Oh, that's like a thing? It's like part of it?
Yeah. But what did you do, Ben? Like you believe like part
of
your...
Is it part of
like
the actual religion or it's just like, it's like thou shalt do this or it just happens to be that Mormons like to prep?
Yeah. So it's been de-emphasized a little bit just because the, you know, more than 50% of the members of the church now are outside the United States. So a lot of them don't have the financial means to do like emergency preparedness, but every member of the church is supposed to have a month of like food and water.
I thought it prepared. Was even higher. I thought it was like six.
It used to be more like a month is kind of the bottom line is sort of the the minimum. And then a lot of people do three or six. We have somewhere between three and six.
To me, doing that is like the same thing of freezing your sperm. So like there's a small chance that something's going to happen to you where you get a car accident and your sperm goes away and you can't reproduce. And for many people, myself included, that would be like the worst thing ever. Like I can't have a kid. So it's like it costs $100 a year in order to do it. I'm going to do that. Prepping is the same exact thing. There's a small chance, but I'll be thankful if there's one in a million that it ever happens.
Well, no. So what I would say, though, is like having food storage and stuff like that is not just good for like the end of the world. But also like if you're in Hurricane Katrina and you can't get out for whatever reason and you just need to be able to like eat for a week, it's good for like emergencies that do happen all the time to people like every day. You know,
all the Mormon mommy bloggers that I follow, which I do follow a lot, they all do a really good
which
job.
Ones?
But they do. I don't remember a lot of their names. But I found them on Instagram and I go to their blog sometimes, but they basically have these like, you know how like at the grocery store, there's like coffee beans and you just pour coffee on top and at the very bottom, you can like, or like they have like granola, coffee, sugar, and you can just like, you know, open the spigot at the very bottom and it just empties out. It seems like what they have those in their homes. And so whenever it's not, it's always topped off though. So the oldest stuff gets, you eat that, but then like you're constantly topping it off. So you always have a constant supply of that stuff. You know, like those containers I'm talking about? Anyway. All right, that's the episode. Uh-huh. Yeah. I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel, never looking back. Like... All right, so when my employees join Hampton, we have them do a whole bunch of onboarding stuff. But the most important thing that they do is they go through this thing I made called Copy That. Copy That is a thing that I made that teaches people how to write better. And the reason this is important is because at work or even just in life, we communicate mostly via text right now, whether we're emailing, slacking, blogging, texting, whatever. Most of the ways that we're communicating is by the written word. And so I made this thing called Copy That. That's guaranteed to make you write better. You can check it out, copythat.com. I post every single person who leaves a review, whether it's good or bad, I post it on the website. And you're going to see a trend, which is that this is a very, very, very simple exercise. Something that's so simple that they laugh at. They think, how is this going to actually impact us and make us write better? But I promise you, it does. You got to try it at copythat.com. I guarantee it's going to change the way you write. Again, copythat.com.